25 miles per hour, and partly to mostly sunny tomorrow, highs in the upper 70s to low 80s, and breezy south winds.
Hello, I'm Nihi Kuksal.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
Lost connection. There's an internet blackout in Afghanistan tonight imposed by the Taliban. The implications are dire, particularly for women and girls, and their loved ones abroad who can no longer reach them. A former Afghan MP and women's rights activist tells us she is terrified.
And command performance. President Donald Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave military leaders an unusual talking to today. A former Army Lieutenant General tells us the meeting did more to rattle the troops than to rally them.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens here in a few moments on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Programming is supported by Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative, providing the energy to help power ideas and strengthen rural development throughout northern Minnesota. More at lakecountrypower.coop. Lake Country Power, energy that powers our lives. Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series this Thursday at noon. This month, hydrologist Sarah Elliott will talk about the ecological implications of forest fires on our water. Register at itascawaters.org. Let's take a listen now to our album of the week. It is called Neon Gray Midnight Green by Nico Case. This is her eighth solo album and her first since 2018's Hell On. Since this last album, many people who influenced her music unexpectedly passed away. Nico Case wanted to dedicate the album to musicians and celebrate the organism that is people making music together. And she cements her place as one of rock's great lyricists with a never-ending stream of vivid images, character sketches, and unexpected phrases. Find more about it at kaxe.org and let us know what you think. Text us 218-326-1234. Song from Nico Case is called Rusty Mountain.
Love songs mostly sound the same. Exercise in futility for me. There's a few who get away with it. They've some divergent insight I can find, and they direct me. No one forced you to fall in love like you did. No one tricked you. You weren't faking it. But they got cold feet or changed their mind, 'cause they got scared or they got bored. Now we're in this boring story that feels unjustly spoiled. It's shelf life, insult to injury. Did you tell them you're not gonna build his house? Let the nails in a pile to form a rusty mountain. Some people need to hurt somebody, anyone. You may as well have been a stranger. You may as well have been one. So I'll round on this chorus with my most unholy gorge. Take your radio and shove it on your he's and she's and running love. I'm not special and I never was. No cruelty made a muse of me seem. Just a two-fisted son of a bitch with no sickening nostalgia for this. Same old cloying story, the same fly paper tongues. We all deserve better than some love song. You may as well have been one. a stranger if I ever was. Gonna build this rusty mountain till we smoke cigarettes on the sun. We all deserve better than a love song.
From our album of the week, that is Nico Cased with Rusty Mountain. The album is called Neon Gray Midnight Green.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
missing links. The Taliban imposes an internet blackout on Afghanistan, a move one Afghan women's rights activist says is as horrifying as when the regime returned to power in the first place.
Rocking the boat, a Jewish activist says everyone on the international flotilla attempting to break Israel's naval blockade of Gaza is on high alert, waiting to be intercepted, but he still hopes to arrive in time for Yom Kippur.
Defense mechanisms. Hundreds of U.S. military leaders were forced to gather today to hear Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's vision for the troops. A retired lieutenant general tells us he doubts that message was well received.
Extended family. As the child of a Métis birth mother with Anishinaabe, Cree, and European ancestors, and the adopted child of a Mennonite father and Ukrainian convert mother, Brittany Penner's family life could be described as complicated.
But those complications make her memoir, Children Like Us, beautiful and unique. She joins me for a feature conversation to mark this National Day for Truth and Reconciliation with a story that offers plenty of both.
And fit to be untied. A growing number of companies are opting for a no-shoes policy in the workplace, giving employees, new and old, a chance to get their feet wet. As It Happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that believes this shows callous disregard. A spokesperson says this measure was taken to prevent vice, and in ostensibly preventing vice, the Taliban has also prevented communication and the flow of information in Afghanistan tonight. The internet watchdog NetBlocks said yesterday that the country was, quote, in the midst of a total internet blackout with multiple networks disconnected, unquote. It also said telephone services were being affected. Today, the UN called on the Taliban to immediately and fully restore internet and telecommunications. Fawzia Koofi is a former Afghan MP and a women's rights activist. We reached her in Islamabad, where she's attending a conference.
Fawzia Koofi, you've always told us every time you come on the program, you know, how when you get up in the morning, your phone is filled with messages from loved ones and colleagues back home in Afghanistan. What was it like today?
Today, when I woke up and I got no message from anyone, I texted in my immediate contacts, like my colleagues and family, and the message was not delivered. It was like one tick in WhatsApp, not double tick. Mm. I was terrified. I woke up from the bed and I was like, it was very scary. It was scary because it looked as that person doesn't exist. I started opening the messages they sent me last night late because I was busy. I was not able to open. And I was like, this only happened a few hours ago. And in a matter of few hours, I have no connection.
It's so...
It was not easy. I mean, today was the most painful. I think it was equal to the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan.
Equal to the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. I think so much of what you said there is remarkable. And people who remember our previous conversations, Fawzia, in case they don't, I mean, you fled in 2021, you're living in exile, you've survived attacks on your life. So when you say something is terrifying, we should believe you. You've experienced many terrifying things. What are other people at the conference saying? Because you're gathered there with other activists trying to build a future in Afghanistan.
More or less, this was the same experience for everybody, because everybody has family in Afghanistan, colleagues, they are running schools like I do, that we teach either ourselves or we hire teachers teach others online. more or less everybody had the same experience. But for me, because, you know, the, as you rightly say, the level of energy, time and commitment I put for a different Afghanistan, including my blood, I had expected a different Afghanistan. For me to see the suffering of people, to see that people are completely, completely cut off. Even for girls, you know, internet was not just connecting with the rest of the world. Internet for girls was more than that. It was learning. It was an opportunity to explore a higher education opportunity. You know, it was just more than internet, more than connectivity. For many women who lost their husbands, I knew that they were connecting online to do business. They were selling their products, their handicrafts. For some others, their husbands were in Pakistan, in Iran, because their husbands were in the army or police. They had to run away. Their husbands or brothers or mother or father was is in Canada, in US, in Europe. And they were basically connecting with their families. I don't even have words. Each time I talk about this, the whole day, I had to keep calm because I didn't want to sound weak. But after the conference finished, it's like basically suffocating. I cannot sometimes even breathe properly.
Fazia.
Because of what's happening to the people. I can at least text message with no reply. But you can imagine those people, no flights, no internet. It's like, you know, you are a human being, but you breathe, but you don't live. Breathing is not equal to living. You need to live. It's a graveyard of humans, Afghanistan, once again.
What could get them to reverse course at this point?
Well, anything the Taliban have said until further notice, that further notice never came. So this time they said internet is cut until further notice. And you know what is even striking? The hypocrisy is that they, their family, their colleagues, everybody is connected with Wi-Fi. But the people, 35 million plus people, that internet was the only means of survival, are not connected to the internet. That is the Hippocratic part of it.
This nationwide expansion, they're not going to reverse it. I hear what you're saying. This expansion, why do you think it's coming now?
Honestly, no one knows. Mm-hmm. One thing is that they are afraid that their atrocities might make them, you know, even weaker, because everyone in Afghanistan who had a phone was a journalist, either reporting to the social media, putting their situation, exposing what the Taliban are doing, or maybe even something bigger. There are all speculations. We don't know what's the truth, but people say there are a lot of differences, and the division among Taliban is getting bigger and bigger, and the so that people are not connected with internet. Yeah. No one knows about their division.
If they're not going to reverse course on their own, and that appears to be the case based on what you're seeing and hearing, what or who could force their hand?
I think the international community, pressure by the international community can. I mean, people of Afghanistan will not hear this because they cannot access internet. So they don't hear my interview. They don't hear how much of pain we are going, and I don't know how much of pain they are going through. So people should resist if they hear me, because this, they don't have anything else to lose. We don't have anything else to lose. We have lost everything. So what are we waiting for? I think international community should really, really take this serious, because the whole Afghanistan is going to be Taliban in 10 years. So is the world ready to face 35 million Taliban with the ideology of Taliban? Because that's what the Taliban want. They want everyone to think the same way as they do. So they cut them off with the development, with light, with future, with a brighter future, with education, with anything that will make them feel liberal, make them feel free and a human being.
Fawzia, I appreciate this. Please take care. I know this is very hard for you. We can hear that in your voice. Please take care.
It is. I don't know how I will sleep, but thank you so much for you and for your colleagues for raising our voice. I only hope that, you know, the people get connected through Starlink. I hope Elon Musk or whoever has the power should come in and connect people of Afghanistan to Starlink.
Please take care, Fawzia. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Fawzia Koofi is a former Afghan MP and a women's rights activist. She's in Islamabad. Global Samud Flotilla's month-long journey to Gaza is nearing its end. The International Flotilla is attempting to breach Israel's naval blockade. Today, an Italian Navy frigate shadowing the flotilla said it was turning around, and as the 40-plus boats neared Gaza, Italy called on the people aboard to do the same. Italian and Spanish naval ships and Turkish drones have been following the flotilla carrying humanitarian aid since last week after activists aboard said they were attacked by drones. Israel has not commented on who's responsible for that drone attack, but repeated an invitation for the boats to drop humanitarian aid in an Israeli port. Israel also reiterated that it will not allow the flotilla to breach the blockade. Since 2010, all flotillas attempting to reach Gaza have been intercepted by Israel. David Adler is a part of the flotilla and is the co-general coordinator of the organization Progressive International. We reached him at sea earlier today.
David, from what you can tell, how far are you from Gaza right now?
So we are entering, at the time of this recording, what's called the Red Zone. The Red Zone is traditionally, in the course of previous efforts to reach Gaza with humanitarian aid, where those efforts have been frustrated through interceptions by Israeli authorities, both violently and what's called light interception. And so we're on very high alert as we speak now for potential drone attacks, as our flotilla has suffered already, but also potential interception in the coming hours.
Timing-wise, how far, if there was nothing stopping you and you were, you know, full speed ahead, how long do you think it would be before you reached Gaza?
Less than 2 days.
What are you seeing? It's late there, I know, but what's your sense of what's happening around you? Are there other vessels? What are you able to see?
So looking around me now, I see very beautiful stars. I see many big drones, large drones flying overhead. And of course, I see a fleet of roughly 40, 45 vessels, many of them humble motor cruisers, others secondhand sailing boats that are all sailing together in unison. As we cruise towards Gaza.
Those, I think, we know that the Turkey, Spain, Italy, and Greece have been monitoring what is happening. Those drones could be from those countries. We don't know, obviously. What is the, you know, I can hear in your voice, you know, this is obviously something you're passionate about, and others who have taken this trip or on this trip feel that way too. But what is the energy and the feeling on board at this stage as the stakes get even higher?
At this stage, we have entered a period of high alert, which means running more regular drills. Obviously, our mission remains the same. We still expect and hope and are protected by international law to reach the shores of Gaza. There is no legal stricture that grants Israel the right to police or manage the boundaries around Gazan shoreline. So we still hope to complete this mission. But we're prepared for all scenarios, light and violent, should we be intercepted along the way.
No flotilla, as you know, has breached the naval blockade of Gaza since 2010. Israel says you could just give us the aid and we'll distribute it. They've also said that this, in their view, is simply a publicity stunt. When you boarded, and now still, do you really believe that you can deliver aid right now in this way?
Absolutely. But I think it speaks to the three very different or distinct but interrelated goals of this mission. The first and foremost is to deliver this aid. All of these vessels are packed to the gills with critical aid for the people of Gaza. That's baby formula, that's food, and that's medicine, stuff that has been restricted at land-based checkpoints, which is why we're traveling by sea. You may or may not be feeling this in Canada, but across Europe and around the world, we're seeing millions of people pouring into the streets, leading strikes in ports or general strikes that are blocking highways and train stations and schools, led by students and workers all around the world in solidarity with this flotilla. And the third objective, which speaks more directly to their question, is do we really think that, you know, this humble mission can in any way correspond to the scale of the suffering and the severity of the genocide in Gaza? Of course not. But our goal from the beginning has been to force the hand of those states who do have the resources, who do have the infrastructure, and do have the capacity, diplomatically as well as economically, to pack their own ships full of humanitarian aid, to sail alongside us, not come up the rear, and actually reach the shores of Gaza themselves.
Italy's prime minister, as you may have heard, is urging you and others to stop this mission at this stage, saying that given the potential peace deal that is in the mix right now, what was announced in Washington yesterday and being looked at, by Hamas at the moment, that you are risking that fragile balance, as Italy's prime minister described it. Does that concern you at all?
I think it's absolute nonsense. The siege of Gaza must be deconstructed in our minds first. We have to denormalize this idea that the state of Israel has ever had any right.
But are you worried you might escalate a situation that is already tense? Even if the intentions when you boarded were to get aid there at this particular moment, does it risk inflaming the situation?
The situation is inflamed. Hour by hour, day by day, Palestinians are being slaughtered and massacred. So no, we're not escalating a situation. We are responding forced to action by the inaction of the governments that supposedly represent us. Our minds are exclusively focused on the suffering of Gazans and how we can aim to ameliorate that suffering in any way, small or large. So no, I see us as absolutely complementary to any peace process.
You wrote a piece today, an open letter, for The Nation, and it's called From the Gaza Flotilla, I'm Here Because My Jewish Heritage Demands It. When did you decide that you needed to be on board, and why?
I think this mission is a moral clarion call for peoples all around the world, and people have distinct motivations. Of course, we're all here based on that common moral conviction that something must be done. But I think that Jews like myself have a special responsibility to stand up to the state of Israel that would seek to usurp, unopolize, and pervert our symbols, our heritage, our culture, and to reclaim them for the principles with which I was raised, which were ones of justice, which were ones of tikkun olam, of healing the world. And I think it's a beautiful coincidence that our flotilla is arriving into so-called Israeli waters. They're Palestinian waters, of course, at the time of Yom Kippur, a time of atonement, when it's a good time for us all to be reflecting as a global Jewish community on the sins that we have committed against the people of Palestine and how we can recover a sense of humanity from the ruins of this genocide.
What do you think the next few hours are going to be like? What do you expect will realistically happen?
It's very, very difficult to tell, and I think that that's part of the Israeli strategy. Normally, these interceptions happen in the dead of night, and it's not as if there is an open dialogue between our flotilla and Israeli authorities who have accused us and smeared us time and again as somehow being Hamasniks in coordination with organized terror, when all around me I just see fathers and mothers and teachers and retirees and nurses and doctors from around the world.
David, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
David Adler is a part of the Global Samud Flotilla. We reached him at sea earlier today. The fact that they were all gathered in one room was odd on its own, but so was the fact that they didn't really know what they were doing there. Today, hundreds of senior leaders in the U.S. military convened at the Marine Corps base in Quantico, Virginia. They had been summoned by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth for a highly unusual meeting that saw generals and admirals fly in from around the world. In his opening address, Mr. Hegseth laid out his vision for the American military, and after him, the leaders also heard from U.S. President Donald Trump, who opened with these remarks.
I've never walked into a room so silent before. This is... Don't laugh. You're not allowed to do that. You know what? Just have a good time. And if you want to applaud, you applaud. And if you want to do anything you want, you can do anything you want. And if you don't like what I'm saying, you can leave the room. Of course, there goes your rank. There goes your future. But you just feel nice and loose, okay? Because we're all on the same team.
Mark Hertling is a retired Army Lieutenant General. We reached him today in Orlando, Florida.
Mark Hertling, is that the kind of icebreaker you would expect from the Commander-in-Chief at an event like this?
I think the Commander-in-Chief was probably a little bit shocked, being used to going into audiences where there's a lot of applause and standing, and he wasn't perhaps expecting, although he probably was told to expect it, the kind of silence and stoicism that he would get from the senior military leaders. But no, that's not the kind of warm-up that I would have liked to have heard, because it seems to go along with what he's done already in terms of firing 12 different senior-ranking general officers since Secretary Hegseth has been his Secretary of Defense and has obviously done it with President Trump's blessing.
There were some familiar talking points. The Defense Secretary spoke about military standards, even facial hair and fitness standards. Then he said this.
Enforcing high standards, not toxic leadership. Leading warfighters toward the goals of high, gender-neutral, and uncompromising standards in order to forge a cohesive, formidable, and lethal Department of War is not toxic. Real toxic leadership is endangering subordinates with low standards. Real toxic leadership is promoting people based on immutable characteristics or quotas instead of based on merit.
He's talking to top generals with a lot of experience. I'm just wondering, do you know anyone currently in the military who is in that room? I mean, have they given you a sense of what they thought of those words?
Yeah, truthfully, Neil, I do know quite a few people that were in the room. I have purposely not reached out to them because I wouldn't have wanted someone to reach out to me and find out, hey, what happened there? But if I can comment on Mr. Hegseth's definition of toxic leadership, I don't think he has it quite right. In fact, there's a doctrinal manual that defines what toxic leadership is, and it's not what he's talking about. In my 40 years in uniform, four decades in the service of our country, I've seen some toxic leaders that lead through ego and wanting to consolidate power for their own personal purposes. They exist in any organization. But truthfully, I've also seen in the military some of the best soldiers, leaders, and teams that I could imagine doing sometimes impossible work. Mr. Hegseth's commentary during his part of the presentation I thought was a little bit insulting and condescending to individuals that have been doing this for 3 and 4 decades.
So what do you think the individuals in that room, knowing what you know of them and the work they do, what are they to do with this information? What do you think they will do with what they heard?
Well, they will, as all good military leaders do, they will adhere to any orders they receive from their civilian leaders. That's a fact. But I know many of them, I would assume, I haven't heard directly from them, but I would assume many of them would really be discouraged and somewhat anxious about some of the comments he made about female soldiers. And truthfully, having grown up in the Cold War, when some of the standards regarding women in the military changed dramatically, all of those things have occurred, in my view, for the better. It has nothing to do with wokeness or diversity. What he talked about in terms of physical standards, the majority of women that I know who were in combat arms, as an example, in the Army, meet those standards. So I'm not sure really what he's addressing this toward or what he's looking to change.
I imagine that there are times when the Commander-in-Chief and the Secretary of Defense call military leaders for meetings like this. You were hinting at how quickly this all came together. What stood out to you about the gathering itself?
First of all, the fact that it was videoed, that this was basically, in the case of Secretary Hegseth, giving very draconian directions to a force of 800 generals and admirals and senior enlisted advisors, all who have served much longer than he has. And he was pretty pointed in his approach. You don't do that in an open forum. You praise in public and correct in private. So having that kind of situation where all of them are getting a mass ass-chewing, pardon my expression, but that's what it was, is contrary to what we believe leadership is all about, number one. Secondly, the environment. The big flag on the stage was reminiscent of the opening scene of Patton. And I think that's what the president was going for, to stand up and give an elaborate pep talk, which was neither inspirational nor influencing of these senior officers, because the president's speech rambled quite a bit. It was much like the UN speech. And he was saying some things that those in the audience probably know much more from on-ground experience about the status than the president does.
There's the intended message, of course, that the U.S. president and the defense secretary are trying to send, it seems. But then there's the message that is received around the world. What are you hearing from your contacts?
Well, I do know from a couple of former leaders in allied countries that used to be my counterparts in various countries. I won't name the countries, but I've received four different messages from former leaders of four different countries. And these were our allies, and they were saying, what's going on? In the case of our foes, I think many of our foes are looking at this and saying, boy, is the U.S. military being disrupted at a very critical time when the threat levels are higher than they've been than during my 40 years of service? And they're saying this is a military and a civil military relationship that appears to be somewhat dysfunctional.
Mark Hertling, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you for having me.
Mark Hertling is a retired lieutenant general with the U.S. Army. We reached him in Orlando, Florida.
Get past the people, get past the hitmen.
James Brown with Get on the Good Foot. Now, of course, Mr. Brown never explains how one is to get on said good foot, nor indeed what it is that makes the foot good, which is frustrating because we all want to get on the good foot, especially at work. Maybe your employment feels precarious. Maybe the hours are too long or too short. Maybe you are barely scraping by, but your boss just bought a giraffe, so his other giraffe wouldn't be lonely. Whatever the case, it's stressful. All you need is a change that will allow you to relax for once. Well, good news. That change is finally happening. At last, some people have heard their employees' concerns, and at last, they're allowing those employees to work without shoes on. This is already commonplace in Silicon Valley, where companies from Cursor to Speak to Whop, all of which exist apparently, have a no-shoes policy. You show up, you take your shoes off, and you put on some slippers, or you pat around in your socks. And shoelessness is getting more popular in the UK as well. Experts say this small, simple policy helps people feel more comfortable and also increases staff cohesion, which is important when you and your team are working 12-hour days, 6 days a week. Now, you might argue that instead of making people work too much in their socks, companies should not make people work too much at all. Well, I'm sure they considered that, but they decided the shoe thing was a better idea. They understood that our relationship with the workplace has been unhealthy for a while, and it's time for the unhealing process to begin. Here's Katie Lang with Barefoot.
When the sun goes down here and darkness falls, the blanket of winter leaves no light at all. You search for shelter to calm.
Katie Lang with Barefoot.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, my feature conversation with Brittany Penner about her new memoir, Children Like Us.
Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
It lays so deep, locking up inside you the dream. Thank you.
listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. More great music continues at 10 o'clock with Headwaters with Malachi Coons. Support comes from the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. Weather for tonight, cloudy with temperatures 55 to 62. Southeast winds up to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny with highs in the upper 70s to low 80s and breezy south winds. Once again, gusting up to 25. Looking ahead to Thursday, sunny and warm, highs 80 to 84. You can answer our question of the week. What do you remember about grocery stores from when you were young? Text us 218-326-1234.
It's often said that when it comes to truth and reconciliation, there's a reason truth comes first. It has to. Without understanding the truth about the intergenerational harm done by residential schools, the 60s scoop, and colonialism more broadly, society cannot begin to correct it. But for the people whose lives have been shaped by that legacy, understanding can be elusive, and truth can be hard to discern. Brittany Penner knows that firsthand. She was born to a Métis mother in 1989, long after the so-called 60s scoop is often assumed to have ended, and her birth mother gave her up for adoption willingly. But for Dr. Penner, the result was the same. Like countless Indigenous children before and after her, she was raised by Caucasian adoptive parents and knew next to nothing about her community of origin until adulthood. Now she's a family physician and lecturer at the University of Manitoba's Max Rady College of Medicine and the author of Children Like Us, a Métis woman's memoir of family, identity, and walking herself home. It was published in Canada this summer, and it will come out in the U.S. on November 4th. We reached Brittany Penner today, the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, at her home just outside Winnipeg.
Brittany, first of all, welcome to As It Happens.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. I want to start with a memory that you say is the strongest, earliest memory that you keep coming back to. And you write about it in a passage. You're describing your mother, telling you the story of your adoption. You're around 4 years old, and she's using a Barbie doll and a 90210 doll of Dylan McKay for 90210 mm-hmm. fans. How did that version of that story go?
It was summer, and we were sitting on her bed. I remember the comforter. I remember the texture of the comforter and the thick kind of fishing line thread. And she had the two Barbies that were white naturally and a white Skipper doll. And interestingly, she also had a baby, but the baby was a brown baby. And as the story went, Skipper had a baby. She couldn't take care of the baby, but Barbie and Dylan really wanted a baby, and so she gave them her baby.
That was it. It's that simple, as you wrote, at least to your mother and father, and it would always remain that simple. But it certainly isn't a simple story. You paint so many vivid images of growing up. You know, your adoptive family is Mennonite, your Ukrainian grandmother, mm-hmm. Baba, who we hear a lot about, also with George, your cousin, collecting fireflies. Those beautiful memories alongside the heartbreaking moments. But what are some of the memories you want our listeners to know to illustrate what you knew of your childhood at that time?
I mean, looking back at it as an adult who has agency and independence and kind of the spirit to want to protect other children, there are a lot of things that I look back on my childhood and wish that if I were there in this form that I could go and protect me and my siblings and my cousins from and comfort us and tell us, you know what, this might seem normal, but it's not. But from what I remember of my childhood, it was me and my siblings. I had, for the listeners that haven't read the book, I had 21 foster siblings throughout my life, from the ages of about just before I turned 2 until I was about 7 that came and went. And then foster cousins and adopted cousins and fostered aunts and uncles and adopted aunts and uncles. And so the way I remember my childhood was me and my cousins and my siblings, we were all Indigenous, all the ones who were adopted and fostered, at least. And we spent a lot of time outdoors and a lot of time at my grandparents' farm. And we were just kind of existing in our own little world, having a very childlike time, making our little worlds in what we knew. And there was this distorted sense of normalcy where there was no Indigenous child really being raised by their parents. We were all being raised by white parents, but that was our normal and we didn't know any different. And so there was the simultaneous messaging of, if you are Indigenous, you are not raised within your original family. And that's just that. And it's because there's something defective in your culture and your family. That was kind of just the given. But then there was also, we were kids and we loved each other and we were just catching fireflies outside and playing in the ditch and playing with electric fences and still having some real childhood moments.
Yeah. While you're having those memories, you do feel worried and scared because you're seeing all these people, the kids, the siblings, the foster children come into your lives and then they leave. And you're adopted, they keep telling you. You're there to stay. Tell our listeners why it was so hard for you to believe them.
I think it was hard to believe them because I think, first of all, my mom grew tired of that question very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't so much a reassurance as when a child gets up in the middle of the night scared of the monsters in the closet or under the bed, and a parent is kind of like, you're fine, it's fine, there's nothing there. It became kind of that exasperated, you're not going to get taken away pretty quickly. But it wasn't a matter of monsters under the bed. It was a matter of very real social workers in a very real system that had already brought me to this family. And there were some very real instances in my life where adopted children did get taken away. And simply being Indigenous left you inherently vulnerable to that reality. And that was a truth that I knew from a very young age. And it was a truth that panned out, yeah, not for me personally, but for others in my life.
In your own home, you stay, but there is a shift, as there is for all of us as we grow up. You see the realities as you grow up. You understand them differently. What kind of impact, though, did that awareness have on you as you became a teenager?
Yeah, I don't think I can separate the fact that I was one of, if not the only Indigenous teenage girl in my junior high at the time. And there is, without question, inherent vulnerabilities in that. And putting that together with being adopted and being raised by parents who didn't understand nor really saw what I was going through. And then also the realization that with most of my friends, I was the only adopted person that they knew, and kind of realizing, oh, perhaps this is not the normal that I thought it was. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I think was quite difficult was, by that point, George and I, who was the closest thing I had to a brother for so much of my life, we had, for various reasons, not been close by that point and lost the really kind of special connection that we had. And so I look at my adolescence and it was a very isolating and lonely time. Mm-hmm. And then it's also naturally a time where you start really questioning your identity, just in terms of like healthy development of a child and teenager. And so it was also very disorienting because I didn't have anyone to really talk with me or guide me through it, or even anyone who had a compassionate ear, really. Yeah.
And we haven't even spoken about so much of what you cover. There is the kinds of loss that I think many people could relate to, certainly. The loss of your cat, Tabby, which you love so much. The loss of family members. But also physical abuse, sexual abuse. But it's one moment after you and your mother barely survive a car accident. A drunk driver nearly kills you both. You're injured, and as you go to the hospital to be treated, you know, as your healing continues, it's the kindness from a doctor in just a few brief moments that is life-changing for you.
Yeah, and it's funny because it really was the briefest moment that he didn't remember, and I know he didn't remember because 10 years later, when I was in medical school at the time, I saw the back of him and I ran up to him and told him, you had this impact on me. And he said a couple words. It was, he had me walk on my tiptoes and my heels and checked my ligaments in my knee. And as he left, he just looked at my mom and he said, her personality is going to carry her far in life. And it was this moment of feeling so seen, but by someone who had this authority, really. And when I ran up to him on the street, it was like maybe 8 in the morning. I don't even remember. And I ran up to him and said, this is like, I'm in medicine now. And this had such a big role to play in it, this small moment. And I think he was quite touched. And I think he had said something along the lines of, because I had said, it's been overwhelming, the amount of information learning in med school. He's like, the information is tiny. It's the other stuff that comes with it that is really a lot to learn. And I didn't really know at the time what he was talking about. And I remember thinking like, yeah, okay, that's easy for you to say because you're 40 years into this or whatever. And now in my practice, I'm like, I get what he was saying because it's the connection with people and it's the moments of seeing them and having that power to say something that can change their day or even their lives that you can't take for granted. And I don't think that he ever did.
You should send him the book.
Yeah, I should. That's a really good, as we're talking about this, I'm like, I should look him up and see.
You're listening to As It Happens. I'm Neil Kuxhall, and I'm speaking with Dr. Brittany Penner about her memoir, Children Like Us. So you also write about, you know, obviously, I think anyone who has been adopted has and knows it is always searching for answers. So digging around, you know, in drawers and finding documents and, you know, just the few pages as you try to piece together what you can. And eventually when you're in medical school, you get a phone call from a social worker who says he knows your birth mother's name. It's Crystal. And that's striking for a few reasons, including the fact that it's a name that you always wanted to change yours to. What did you think when he said those words to you?
It was very surreal. I mean, the entire moment was surreal. I was as early as 7 or 8 where I literally asked my mom, can we change my name to Crystal? Because I was just enamored with this name. I just thought it was the prettiest, beautiful, coolest name. And I just thought that it suited me. And it still feels a bit surreal to me, this thread that seems to be present long before I even was aware of its existence.
You meet. You see the photograph first, you search for it, and you meet. Just tell our listeners a little bit about what making that connection in person finally was like.
Yeah, it was a lot to hold in one moment that I didn't realize would be so much to hold. And in particular, I'm talking about, I knew there would be excitement and happiness and a sense of what I thought would be a homecoming. And the one thing I was not prepared for was the grief that also came with it. And that took me years, I think, to even acknowledge and allow myself to feel. Because I think another big theme in my life and subsequently the book is this narrative that, well, if you're going to feel anything, you need to just feel grateful. You need to feel grateful for this white Mennonite family that took you in when they didn't have to. And you need to feel grateful for all the things that your family did for you, and you need to feel grateful that you were given a different life, and you need to feel grateful, grateful, grateful. And so the fact that some grieving and sort of recognition that this is a person to whom I am deeply connected but was severed from very early. All of this unacknowledged emotional weight was carried with me into that moment meeting her. And I thought I was very fully prepared, but I was only prepared for the good feelings. And so meeting her, there was this recognition of this is who I come from. And it's undeniable because I looked at her and her the way she sat with her shoulders and her hands on her lap. It was in some ways looking like looking at a mirror. Mm-hmm. And then all of the difficult stuff came afterwards that wanted to kind of peek through and wanted to be like, hey, I'm here too. Like, I'm sad because here's this person that you couldn't know for the most fundamental, foundational moments of your life. And that's sad.
And as with your relationship with your adoptive parents, your relationship with your birth mother, it's complicated. There are ups and downs and ebbs and flows to those connections and conversations. And as our listeners heard, you were born in 1989. You never thought of yourself as a survivor of the 60s scoop. But as you grow and you speak with other Indigenous people, you know, other family connections, you come to realize that you are a part of what was done then and how it continued on much, much, much later than the 1960s. And you write a column that describe yourself as, quote, a Métis child of the 60s scoop adopted by Mennonites, unquote. And your birth mother objects to this. Why?
Yeah. I suspect she is someone who is very independent and very, very much never wants to see herself as a victim, like to her credit, mm-hmm. never wants to see herself as a victim or as someone who something was done to outside of her ability to say yes or no. And so I think when she looks at my adoption, there was a sense of I made this decision. It doesn't matter anything outside of it. This was a decision I made for the two of us. And I had just said from my perspective, even though this was an important decision to her, like there were still so many outside policies that led to her making this decision. And she highlighted for me too that the social worker she had met with once before having me and before relinquishing me was a really uncomfortable encounter. And she had also commented, which I say in the book, that that you know, maybe he shouldn't have been around teenage girls. And she didn't elaborate more on what that meant. But even the that detail is kind of like, well, there's something in that too. And there's something in our history of my great grandmother hiding in the bush from Indian agents with my grandmother. And then my grandmother having a child, one of my aunts, and it's unclear whether she lost my aunt or was coerced in giving her up. But there's this generational pattern of having those choices taken away that sometimes I've wondered if that happens so often in a family line. Is there a messaging at some point to say, you know what, I'm going to be the one to make a decision so it's different than my mother's or my grandmother's or so and so forth, that plays into that as well. And at the end of the day, it was the system that decided where I went and to whom I went and what culture I was placed in. And that's also a component of the 60s scoop too, is that that decision was left to a government agency.
Have any of your family members read what you've written, read this book?
George has.
Oh, yeah.
He has read it. He's read it multiple times because he was the only one that he would have had the power to look at the book and be like, Britt, I don't think that this maybe reflects our family in an accurate way, or I'm not comfortable with you sharing this or whatever. And I would have changed it without question. And he didn't. In fact, he had said, like, I feel seen in ways that I didn't realize I needed to be seen. And that has meant more to me than anything, probably, because he is the one who I think can relate to my experiences in a way that no one else can, like my personal experiences. And apart from him, if anyone else has read it, they haven't let me know.
It's wonderful, having read the book, to know that you and George have this enduring connection and that he read this book over and over again. Because when you're separated and then you see each other again in high school and you can't really talk like you used to. So to go from Firefly Catching to that separation to this is beautiful to hear. There's other beautiful news, as I understand it. You're expecting your first child as we conduct this interview. So what is it like? What has it been like to be pregnant as you put this book that you've worked on for so long? It's your life out into the world as well.
Yeah. It has been a very, there's been a lot of gestation and laboring on both fronts. And it's also come with grief that I didn't expect either. Well, perhaps that I would have known might come up, but I didn't know how or when. And so a simple example would be pretty early on, we found out that we were having a daughter. And that was a reality that shook me. Mm-hmm. I think because of the history again with my birth mother's first child was a daughter. It was me. My grandmother's first child was a daughter. My great grandmother's first child was a daughter. And pending, nothing happens. And this is a very, very vulnerable thing for me to say. I have this pervasive fear of having my child taken away, which on paper, there certainly is not anything that would flag anything, but it's a fear that just it's lived with me. And pending that doesn't happen, it will be the first time in over 100 years in my direct line where there hasn't been a government presence with the birth of our first child. And so, like I said, my great grandmother hid in the bushes with my grandmother from Indian agents, and my grandmother lost her first child, and then my mother never held me, and the first person to hold me was maybe a nurse or a social worker. And so there's this kind of significance that's not lost on me in that way.
Dr. Penner, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for this, and congratulations on all fronts.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. I've enjoyed this time so much.
Brittany Penner is a family physician and the author of Children Like Us, a Métis woman's memoir of family identity and walking herself home. We reached her at home in Manitoba.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.